Hello and welcome to the Young Fabians podcast. I'm Nathan Hodson, and today Marie and I are hosting the podcast. We're from the Young Fabians West Midlands Network.
Today we're joined by Mike Foster, who is the former Labour MP for Worcester from 1997 to 2010. Nathan, I know you grew up in Worcester, so for those of us who haven't visited, do you want to tell us a bit about the background of a city that's so close to your heart?
Yeah, absolutely, Marie. So 25 miles south of Birmingham, Worcester sits on the River Severn in the shadow of the Malvern Hills. Known as Wee Organ by the Anglo-Saxons, it's been inhabited for over 2,000 years. And since 1084, the city centre has been dominated by the impressive cathedral, which is the last resting place of King John. A stone's throw from the cathedral is the commandery, Charles II's headquarters during the Battle of Worcester. Charles's forces were routed by Cromwell's parliamentarians, but after the Restoration, the city sought favour with the monarchy and took the motto Civitas in bello et pace fidelis, the faithful city in war and peace. In 1751, this city saw the launch of Royal Worcester Porcelain, one of a succession of globally successful industries emerging from the unassuming south of the Midlands. Beyond faithful worship at the cathedral and fidelity to the crown, in the modern era, the city has put its faith in the Conservative Party. Between 1885 and 1997, the city loyally returned Tories to Westminster for 111 of 112 years, only wavering in the 1922 election when a Liberal MP was elected, who lost his seat the year after. In the post-war election of 1945, the Tory Etonian George Ward beat Labour's candidate by 4 votes, but that was the closest to victory Labour would come for half a century. In 1961, Peter Walker won a by-election with a majority of 5,397, beginning a 31-year period as the city's MP and a leader in the Conservative Party. By Thatcher's election, Walker had increased his majority to over 10,000, and after Walker stood down, Peter Lough won the 1992 election with a reduced majority of around 6,000. Following boundary changes, he perhaps sensed the wind changing and a century of Tory dominance coming to an end, and in 1997, Lough contested the mid-Worcestershire seat instead. That was the year our guest today first stood in Worcester. I was 4 years old, and I remember my parents going down to the primary school in the south of the city where I lived and casting their vote for Labour. And that day, with a 12.3% swing, he was the first ever Labour MP for the city, and he held the seat for 13 years. During this time, Worcester Royal Hospital was built just outside the city. The College of Higher Education became University of Worcester in 2005. The city now boasts a student population of 10,000. It grew and thrived. And then came the 2008 financial crisis. The city felt the effects, and among the wreckage, the Royal Worcester Porcelain Factory finally ceased production. In 2010, as the country decided whether to pursue Gordon Brown's Keynesianism or David Cameron's austerity, Worcester elected the Tory Robin Walker. The St Paul's educated son of Peter Walker, 18 years after his father vacated the seat, had a majority of 2,982, the smallest Conservative majority in Worcester since 1945. But in 2015, he almost doubled it. And then came the Brexit referendum, which saw 53.7% of voters in Worcester choose to leave. The following year, Walker's majority was cut to 2,500, but in the disastrous 2019 general election, he increased his majority to 6,758. Slightly larger than Peter Lough's 1992 majority. But if there's one thing we know about Peter Lough's 1992 majority, it's that Labour could overturn it at the next election. With a majority so slender, Worcester's well within the 126 seats Labour needs to win to secure control of the House of Commons in 2024. So what happened in 1997? Where's Worcester Woman now? And how were the voters of Worcester persuaded to elect their first Labour MP? Did the faithful city find its faith again in 2010? And what will it take for Keir Starmer to shake that faith and perhaps inspire the kind of loyalty which the people of Worcester showed to 3-time winner Mike Foster? With us today is the man himself. Mike, I wonder whether you could tell us what kind of things you think of when you think of Worcester and whether you think the picture I've just given of the city is fair.
I think it is a fair description, Nathan. It's a sort of thing that you find in the sort of touristy guidebooks added to, you know, political almanac. What people imagine when they conjure up an image of Worcester is a nice, sort of prosperous cathedral city, no problems, all very nice and genteel. And on the face of it, if you, you know, walk into the city centre, you've got the cathedral, you've got the cricket ground, you've got the Guildhall, you know, fantastic building. And you think, yeah, I can see this as, you know, this genteel place. But underneath the surface, when you then move a little bit out of the city centre into the suburbs, you see, you know, a very typical microcosm of the country as a whole. And that's the history to Worcester Woman being created. Worcester Woman was a Tory central office creation in the back end of the John Major government. And their strategists had identified, you know, what they called was, you know, a part-time working mom as the person that they really needed to attract to stop Tony Blair becoming Prime Minister. And the reason why they picked Worcester, apart from the alliteration of Worcester Woman, was that Worcester, socioeconomically, is almost the perfect microcosm of the UK as a whole. If you look at all the stats around home ownership, education, ethnicity, they're all pretty average for the UK as a whole. So beneath that genteel exterior that Worcester portrays, there is a pocket of everything that you find across the country as a whole. And that's what makes it such an interesting parliamentary seat and why it's always going to be, on the current boundaries, a marginal seat that the two main political parties fight so strongly for.
And you mentioned the data, kind of, and the demographics of Worcester there. And we've been looking at some data from 2019, just before the election, where a polling company used multi-level regression to estimate support for different propositions in constituencies across the country. So it's not a foolproof method because it doesn't take into account local culture. It only really gives a demographic account of attitudes. So we thought it would be interesting to try some of those ideas off you, see if you can kind of estimate whether Worcester would have been above average constituency for this proposition or below average. And perhaps the listeners at home will want to play along. And at the end, we can see whether we actually agree with what this multi-level regression found. So the first one I wanted to ask you was whether you think Worcester as a constituency is above average or above the median constituency or below the median constituency in support for the monarchy.
It would be above average in support for monarchy, would be my guess.
Well, that's interesting because that would have been my guess as well. According to this data, demographically, Worcester would be below average with 429 constituencies more royalist than Worcester, which is surprising.
The next one is the statement, immigrants should be free to move to Britain and work. Do you think Worcester was more or less supportive of this than the median constituency?
It's a good question. My instinct is it probably would be less supportive of that statement.
Worcester's actually really supportive of this. 455 constituencies were more anti-immigrant than Worcester was.
And so one more kind of demographic kind of question is how about this traditionally conservative claim that tax rates for high earners should be minimised to keep the UK competitive? Was Worcester more supportive or less supportive than the median constituency?
The challenge here is to try and work out what the other constituencies think as much as what Worcester thinks. And my instinct is that probably Worcester would be quite supportive of that argument, but I suspect other constituencies are more supportive of that, if you see what I mean.
Well, that's, I mean, demographically, yeah, Worcester was relatively sceptical of the reasoning 481 constituencies would have been more convinced of that. But it's interesting, you know, that's just based on the people in Worcester, but and it's quite surprising, isn't it? So perhaps it's not true, and perhaps actually in Worcester there is a culture which you know from being there, which defies those averages. Yeah, so I don't know how you got on at home. Louis, our producer, didn't get any of them right and was really surprised about it all. But I think it's interesting to bring those figures today to tell a different story about Worcester, because there's a bit of a bias that places like Worcester are kind of full of little C conservative people. But on this data, I think it's potentially Worcester is actually a very unnatural Tory seat relative to the rest of the country, by no means necessarily anti-immigrant, in principle open to taxing the well-off, you know, very modern, very progressive. I don't know whether you think that picture's better than the archaic picture that I gave you before.
I think the challenge with using the comparison with other constituencies is that is, you know, their particular outlooks may be, you know, somewhat different. I would always try and look at these sort of challenges as to, you know, what does the majority view, you know, what is that in Worcester? You know, where do the majority stand on support for the monarchy? Where do the majority stand on issues like taxing wealth or on freedom of movement and immigration? And that, you know, that gives you a sort of snapshot. But because, you know, as I said, Worcester's this archetypal, you know, Middle England, socioeconomically average seat, there are always going to be sort of fairly average views when taken across the city as a whole. And what you have to try and unpick as a political figure in the city, and one that tries to be electorally successful, is where are those pockets and how do you get those pockets to support you? So if you look at, you know, people in private rented sector, you could pretty much work out where those houses are, and they're going to be, you know, probably either fairly average for the UK as a whole. But what do you do to appeal to them whilst you also appeal to owner-occupiers, because you've got a mix of everybody in your constituency? Whereas if you go to some of the places in, let's say, you know, inner city Birmingham, the population is skewed to certain demographics or skewed towards certain housing characteristics or you know, educational backgrounds. And so you've got a higher proportion in your constituency. So that's what makes Worcester the electoral challenge, that it's complex in the sense you've got to appeal to pretty much everybody. And that's why it's, you know, it is difficult to perhaps get a single campaign or a single issue that you can get behind that you know will, you know, sweep you to power. It's not like that. It's far more complicated.
So we would really like to hear about the events that led up to your election in 1997. So could you tell us a bit about what happened before you were elected?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've been honest with people, for years on this issue. You know, without doubt, I think Labour would have won the 1997 general election, whether John Smith was the leader or whether Tony Blair was the leader. I think Labour were poised to win. The size of the victory, I think, was what was so interesting. And I think that was the difference between the two leaders. So, you know, with the sad death of John Smith in, you know, in the mid-90s and Tony Blair becoming leader, that completely transformed the political outlook of places like Worcester. And then when you add into the mix a boundary change that was far more favourable to the Labour Party, it made Worcester a far more winnable seat, whoever the candidate was. And, you know, I was incredibly lucky that I was in a position, I think, when the party and party members and the country was looking for a fresh start. So, you know, I was 34 when I was elected as a Member of Parliament for Worcester. You know, historically, that's a relatively young age, and I'm not, you know, not arrogant enough to think it was just because of me. It wasn't. It was because Tony Blair was this young, fresh face of the Labour Party, and people were looking for young, fresh faces and fresh outlooks. So when I went into Parliament at 34, I was by no means the youngest. There were an awful lot of people younger than me, and that was, you know, it was a time. It was a moment in time in political history that will be very difficult to repeat, and we shouldn't look to try and repeat it, other than the sense of it was a great win, and we should always be looking to win power because that's when you can make changes. So we can't, you know, we can't turn the clock back. We should not even look to turn the clock back. But what we have to do is look at where we are now and what we can do to win. And that was, you know, that's where we were in 97. We did everything we possibly could to win. We were totally disciplined about our message. We poured resources into marginal seats like never before. And we had a leader that actually could cross all sorts of prior political affiliations and had that broad appeal, so that in places like Worcester, and I'll keep going back to the point that it's averaging everything, and if you've got a leader that can appeal to a broad range of people, that's how you win power. Certainly in places like Worcester, you know, you will do very well if you can have a leader and a party that has got that breadth of appeal. And that was what was so significant about the sort of 97, and probably the same for the 2001 election results.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, like, you say you don't want to go backwards, but we were still wondering, in your campaign before 1997, what were you offering to the voters in Worcester for this election, and what was it that particularly connected with people?
You go back to the point I made about message discipline, and we carried those pledge cards with us. I don't know if there's some archive material of the famous pledge card. You know, there were the five key pledges, and they were the cornerstone of the offer to the electorate. And because we were absolutely disciplined in our message, we stuck very much to the five core pledges and what they would mean to families and people in Worcester. And that was the basis of the election campaign. Obviously, bolted onto that would be a number of local issues that, you know, you sort of made work towards this central theme. There was no good having a local message that ran counter to the five key pledges. And the party was, you know, focused on the five key pledges. Ministers and shadow ministers, I should say, were absolutely disciplined in terms of what they said when they came to visit places like Worcester. So it was all about those five key pledges, and that was important because it actually gave the party that political discipline as to not just promising everything to everybody, because that way it wouldn't be taken seriously. And we'd had a Tory government for 18 years. We were sick and tired of losing. So we were going to do everything in our power to make sure that we did win, and that meant being disciplined. But also, after the election in 97, it became the cornerstone for the delivery. So, you know, the Labour government went out of its way to make sure that those five pledges, the promises, were actually kept. Now, that's, you know, that isn't easy. The delivery in government is far more difficult than the promise in opposition. But having said that, it was delivered. And then that helped in the 2001 campaign, because we could say to the electorate, you know, hand on heart, we promised this, we delivered it. Now here's the next promise. And then you've got that trust between the people and politicians that, sadly, I don't think we have now, but we had then, and that was, you know, that was an important element of not just winning once, but winning twice and then the third time. It was all about building up that picture of, A, they'd make a promise. It might have been limited. People were critical of it being quite a limited promise, but it was delivered. And then when fresh promises came along, there was the confidence amongst the electorate that they were going to get delivered. And not sidetracked by, you know, every, you know, single issue that might come along. But there were, as I say, local issues that were also, you know, relevant. And, you know, one of them being the hospital in Worcester that you mentioned in your introduction, Nathan. You know, the promise of the delivery of a new hospital. That was a key central plank, and one that was fought over politically in the run-up to 97. And then became a focus of individual campaigning. And, you know, I have to say, you know, yeah, that was, you know, one of the things that I was absolutely determined to see through, was having had the promise before 97 that we would get a new hospital, making sure that we did indeed get that new hospital. And again, delivery wasn't easy. Delivery's the difficult bit, but the most rewarding bit in government.
I think the Labour Party now are beginning the process of like rebuilding that trust. You mentioned that there was the pledge card and Labour really stuck to what they said they were going to do and followed through with it. When in their first term, Labour were fast in introducing minimum wage and devolution. How were these motions received in your constituency?
Well, you know, in the run up to the election campaign, we had made various promises, and you know, one of them obviously was around a minimum wage. And like in any other campaign, those who were opposed it, you know, drummed up support for their cause. And yes, you know, it seems odd now, because everybody believes in a national minimum wage and they're trying to outdo each other in whether it's a living wage or a London living wage. And people have just accepted the fact that we have that safeguard. But to actually get that legislation through Parliament was an unbelievably tough ask. We had a huge majority, but the opposition, the Conservative opposition at the time, were determined to delay the introduction of that legislation as best they can. And I have to say, that was the first time in my life I had been awake for more than 24 hours, you know, full stop, because we were trying to vote through this legislation against the you know, the opposition of the Tories. Now, we had a big majority, and so there was a bit of a rota system to get the work through, and I was one of the MPs, you know, new backbench MP, you know, you're on duty. And, you know, bless him, you know, the Minister Ian McCartney was there at the dispatch box for that period of time. And it, you know, and people now look back and say, oh, well, you know, Labour and the Tory, and must, oh, they're both the same. They're not. You know, when you're faced with, you know, with a 24-hour plus stint without a break to drive through something that you know is morally and economically a sensible thing to do, in, you know, in the eyes of the opposition of the, you know, of the Tories at the time, it wasn't, and we had to fight them to get that legislation on the statute book. So I always say, you know, delivery is really difficult. The promise is easy, and something like the minimum wage, it would have appealed to a, you know, certain group of the electorate for whom it was economically important. You know, they had incredibly low wages, and they had a very real boost by the by the minimum wage coming into force. There'd be others who knew that it was the right thing to do because it was morally the right thing to do. There will be some, I have no doubt, who objected to it and still probably object to it. But now it's mainstream, and I can share with you, I hate doing the name-dropping bit, but I will share with you a conversation I had in March 2010. And it was on the runway at the airport in Haiti. And I was sent over there as Minister for International Development, and Bill Clinton was there at the same time. And I had half an hour with Bill Clinton, a one-to-one conversation. And he told me what he thought was going to happen in the forthcoming general election. You know, he called it right. He knew, obviously, my circumstances, and he knew I was going to be at the sharp end. But he forecast that Labour were going to lose that election. And what he said to me, and it stays with me to this day, he said, well, whatever happens, the Labour government from 1997 to 2010 have changed the outlook of life in the country. He said that the Conservative Party have had to change to adjust to what Labour has led on. So things like the minimum wage are a classic example, and that's why I use the Bill Clinton story, because it's a classic example of what we brought in. It was vehemently opposed at the time, but it is now mainstream. You look at issues around equalities, it's now mainstream. You look at issues around gay rights, it's now mainstream. You know, these were, you know, fought over, you know, really fiercely in those early years of the Tony Blair government. but they became locked in and cemented, thankfully, into you know what the UK does going forward.
So you talked about local policy, local views on national policy and local campaigns, and I think one of the really interesting things about that you were quite well known for early on was hunting. In 1997, you introduced a private member's bill to ban hunting with hounds. Much of that was incorporated into the 2004 Hunting Act. Worcester is, in many ways, like fairly rural. I walked through the farms by Red Hill Lane on my way to the school when I lived there. And I suppose I wondered what made you choose to address that issue and how was that received locally? Because it seems like quite a difficult one for that constituency.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say, Nathan, is obviously, you know, I used to live in Bedhill Lane, so you'd walk past my house when you were going to school. So, Worcester is not a seat that lends itself automatically to being, this will be the hotbed of anti-hunt organisations. And there's a long story about how that came about. First of all, when you're going for election and you have your views on key issues, and I was always instinctively anti-hunt. Didn't understand why anybody would want to do it, but I have to say it wasn't at the forefront of why I went into politics. I previously was teaching at the technical college in Worcester, the College of Technology, as it was. So that was my background, if you like. But I was lucky in the sense, and I use that in sort of inverted commas, that my name was drawn out of the hat in the ballot for the private members bill in 1997. So I drew number one. So I could pick whatever legislation in theory, so the textbooks tell you, that you want to bring in. Now, there are limits as to what you can bring forward as legislation, but you can bring all sorts of topics to have them debated just to get a bit of airtime if that's what you wanted. And at that moment, without doubt, my life changed in the sense that I hadn't expected to be drawn out of the hat, number one. Clearly the odds are against you. And I had the choice. So I went to the local paper, the Worcester Evening News, and I asked them if they wanted to run a sort of competition, a poll, whatever way you'd want to describe it, as to what the readers of the Worcester Evening News thought I should take up as an issue. I'm frankly guided by the fact that all politics is local. And if you did something that was clearly supported by the local paper, then that was going to be something that was, you would do all right by. They're not going to attack you for doing something that their readers wanted. But I had not got a firm view at that point what I wanted to do. The issue of hunting the dogs came up overwhelmingly amongst the readers in that survey. It was 8-9-1, something like that. So it was an overwhelming view that's the issue that I should take up. Now, part of that is the lobbying that goes on by pressure groups and the debate that kicked off. I also, faced with this choice, I also had looked at the Mori opinion poll findings that had been done. And I had a private audience with Bob Worcester, who was the head of Mori at the time, to go through what those opinion poll findings were, to be reassured that if I did take up this issue, that the newspaper polling, if you like, was not dissimilar to where the public were in Worcester. Because there's always a risk of that. A sort of self-identifying poll is not the same as an opinion poll conducted statistically in a valid way. And overwhelming majority of people in Worcester wanted to see hunting with dogs banned. So this sort of genteel cathedral city that you walk through, Middle Batten Hall Farms on your way to school, Nathan, that's 80, I think it was, it was over 80% wanted to see hunting with dogs banned. So if you know that 80% of your electorate want to see this issue dealt with. You've got the support of your local paper and its readership to take up this issue. It's an enormous influence to say, actually, do you think this is right or wrong? And instinctively, you're against hunting, and you've got an opportunity to do something about it. That's what politics is about. It's about making change. So that's the sort of background as to how that, this sort of roller coaster ride that I decided to sit on came about. And as you say, it on and off. It started in June 97 and ended in the Hunting Act 2004. So, an election had gone by, no end of attempts to get the legislation through, but fundamentally, the Private Members Bill I championed in 1997 became the basis of the Hunting Act. Yeah.
So it wasn't in any sense. Here's a hobby horse of mine, and I'm going to try and drive this through and make it all happen. But instead, it was something that was really kind of carefully planned politically, and part of a wider sense of, well, Labour needs to remain in power. We've got to be very careful about that. And very disciplined about how we approach things. I think that's interesting because looking back, it seems like a bit of a stroke of genius to force the Tories to either side with the worst instincts of their base and appear like out of touch toffs, or alienate their base and split the party. I mean, is that how it felt at the time?
I'd love to be able to claim that I thought through the political strategy. In that sense, I didn't. It was about what can be done, and I don't think it's a secret to say that I was under enormous pressure not to take this issue up. I had a number of meetings with the Labour hierarchy in terms of the Chief Whip at the time, who was trying to steer me towards alternatives. Major important political initiatives like MOTs for caravans. There was no way, with the euphoria of an election winning in May 1997 and everything that was around that, and the expectation of so many people, to have an opportunity to deal with something that in your constituency and in the country as a whole, 80% of people wanted to see an end to. It would have, for me, it would have been a crazy political decision not to do it. But I didn't do it thinking this is going to split the Tories and et cetera, et cetera. That wasn't my thinking at the time. I'm conscious that the issue did cross political boundaries. And I knew at the time, because of the polling, that the majority of Conservative supporters, that is voters, were against hunting with dogs. That might not have been their party policy, but I knew that that's where, in Worcester certainly, the majority view was of Conservative Conservative voters as individuals. And I'm always grateful to the support I received from members of the opposition as Conservative MPs who were anti-hunt, who enabled the legislation to go forward on a cross-party basis, because the mistake that we probably would have made would have been to make it party political with a private members bill. So you needed to get broad support. So I got support from the likes of, Anne Widdecombe, Roger Gale, David Amos, quite right-wing backbench Tory MPs, but were anti-hunt. Liberal Democrats, people like Simon Hughes, were very supportive. The SNP were supportive. You could pull together a broad cross-party coalition to bring this legislation to a head and win a great vote. When it came to the initial vote in November 1997, it was a huge majority in the Commons in favour of passing the legislation. But it was, it was also equally important that across the country, that view was reflected as well. And, I'm pleased that, the Tory party are now in a position where they don't want to bring forward this issue anymore. Now, yes, the legislation needs tightening up. Experience has taught us what we perhaps feared might happen in terms of how the situation was gamed by those who want to continue with the pursuit that they have. But it can be sorted out. You can always sort that legislation out and tidy it up. But importantly, it's a bit like, you know, the minimum wage. The Tory party now support minimum wage. The Tory party now support the ban on hunting with dogs. Who would have thought that in 1997? No one.
I suppose it strikes me as a little bit analogous to the school meals votes. Today, you know, you see the Conservative Party not voting for extending school meals for children at the moment. And I think that's been a deliberate strategy to try and divide, you know, to try and draw a dividing line between Labour and the Tories at the moment. But it's really interesting that you were able to go cross-party at that time. Do you see a different political culture now to the one that you were experiencing then?
Not necessarily. I think the issue and the delivery of the issue meant it had to be really cross-party to get the type of support we needed. And historically, hunting with dogs had been a sort of free vote issue. So it lent itself to cross-party working. But the, you know, what I see now in terms of the discussions around school meals and campaigns like, you know, led by Marcus Rashford, what I see is a Conservative Prime Minister that frankly is perhaps more interested in the PR and what things look like than actually delivery on the ground. So he was more than happy initially not to see any provision for people who were in need. But as soon as the PR battle changed, as soon as, you know, you saw a petition, you saw Marcus Rashford campaigning, Boris Johnson, he just basically saw how the media were viewing this and switched the policy over. Now, you know, that's what you can do in government. That's why you obviously want to be in government. You can actually make things happen and make change that's real to people. But the difficulty for, you know, Labour at the moment is, you know, we're in opposition and we're not even close to forming government. You know, we're 4 years away from an election. We're facing an 80-seat Conservative majority. And anything good that we say or do at this stage, if it's got great PR value, and if you think you want to win an election, you want stuff that's popular to be, you know, upfront as your policy. If it's popular, Boris Johnson will have no qualms in about just lifting the idea and claiming it for himself. And that's the real challenge that you have with somebody who's not necessarily ideologically driven, but is driven just by what's in the papers the day before or the day after that. It's an odd position that Labour finds itself in, and a very challenging one for Keir Starmer.
Sort of changing topics a little bit now. Later on in your parliamentary career, you became the Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for the Department for International Development. Recently, Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson have begun rolling back support for international development, moving the Department for International Development into the Foreign Office and reneging on the commitment to spend 0.7% of GDP on international development. So when you were an MP, Gordon Brown brokered a deal in which the G7 wrote off more than £30 billion of debt for the poorest countries in 2005, which was an incredible Labour achievement, and it showed real global leadership. So can you tell us about how international development was approached when you were in government?
Sure. I mean, you know, firstly, let me say that when I had a phone call from Gordon Brown in 2008 to say, I've got a job for you, will you do this? Clearly, your first instinct is always to say yes. You know, it's a given. Your Prime Minister's offering you a ministerial role like that. You're going to do it. But I have to say, it was the best job in the world and an experience that will never, ever leave you. And in many ways, help shape your thinking going forward as well. I mean, it's a fantastic role to have. It was a great department to work in. The people in DFID were the most professional. They were the hardest working, the most determined to deliver on the political promises that were made by the Labour government. It was a privilege to work with them. And what we were trying to do at the time was to ramp up the spend from the historically low levels. I think in 1997 it was about 0.26% of GDP was spent on aid. I think by the time we left office it was around, I think it was 0.52. I think we'd moved, you know, in effect we doubled it as a share of national income, and we were on the way to that 0.7 internationally recognized figure. And you know, in terms of what we were trying to do, we were focusing on the poorest in the world. We we have got a hugely ambitious manifesto going forward, because we knew that the UK was in a position of real global leadership when it came to international development, not only because of the journey that we had been on in terms of our spend, significant, but it wasn't just that. It was the sheer ability of that department to deliver on the ground in whatever circumstance. You know, the department was at the forefront of thinking around writing off debts. It was at the forefront of thinking around girls' education, around water and sanitation, you name it. DFID was at the forefront of thinking. And that's why having a department separate from the Foreign Office was always was a prize. Wasn't like that before 97. We created DFID in 1997, so it was a Labour creation. And we fought for it being a standalone department because we wanted development to be the prize. It wasn't just to be a tool of how do we get more UK exports? Well, we'll do a deal with, you know, we'll give them a bit of development money. That's not what development was about. Development was something that should be done in its own right because of the value that it brought. And the argument that we made at the time was actually, it was not just the right thing to do, you know, morally, ethically, it was actually in our interest to do it as well. There were huge, you know, amount of, you know, we called it enlightened self-interest, because for the country as a whole, it was much better, and you know, history will prove us right on this, much better to try and develop and help encourage some of the poorest countries of the world to change their health systems, to develop their own economies, to help some of the poorest in the world stay within their boundaries, because the international way, because they could see that their country was becoming more prosperous, rather than see this mass migration of people actually, you know, attracting, you know, international criminal gangs to you know, help people try and cross the English Channel and perish in doing so. Much better for everybody if we can have countries growing their own wealth and having a stable environment, a peaceful environment for them to raise their families, and then no need to take the risk, the huge risk of traveling thousands of miles to a future that would be at best uncertain. So that was, you know, that was one of the issues. But you know, frankly, what I found was that development was also one of those issues that crossed party divides. There were a number of people working in civil society in the UK, be it the, you know, Rotary clubs or Oxfams of this world, who genuinely want to do the right thing. They may vote politically, you know, conservative, let's say, but they actually understand that there is a bigger dimension out there, a more ethical case that needed to be made. And you know, our church partners in international development were incredibly powerful and strong advocates for not just increased spending, but sensible spending, and this sense that global leadership actually meant something. And I get that I was incredibly lucky. I could actually see what that global leadership meant. And I would love, total pipe dream, but it would have been great to take a chunk of your electorate with you to see what UK aid actually does on the ground. And so, you know, when I was there, we started to do, you know, it sounds really, you know, really, you know, odd now, but in the day, doing video blogs, you know, was a novel way of actually communicating. And so we started to take handheld video cameras so we could actually bring back and tell a story. You know, we knew people couldn't come with us, so let's take that story back to the UK to show the real impact of development work. And things like that, I think, were probably missing after 2010. I still think the people involved in the department as ministers knew the value of UK aid, but what they probably forgot to do was to try and make the case to sustain UK aid. And if over a 10-year period between 2010 and 2020, you don't make the case, it's very easy then to sort of, oh, well, we'll cut it a little bit and we'll merge the department. No one will notice. No one will kick up a fuss. And they probably won't, unless they were involved within the civil society groups, or they were, you know, MPs with an interest in international development. And yet, you know, the great shame is that our global leadership will be diminished. You know, I've met with prime ministers and presidents and senior ministers all over the world, all of whom have said what a great job the UK does in terms of its international development aid. And that's the great, you know, the great oddity, that certainly in 2010, in the run-up to the general election, that all the opinion polls said we were going to lose. You know, we all knew we were probably going to lose. I would sit with a range of prime ministers who would say how wonderful Gordon Brown was because of what he had done post the financial crash to stabilise world economies and make sure that the poorest in the world didn't suffer the hardship that they would have done ordinarily. They thought he was wonderful for that international global leadership that he had brought. And yet back at home, we were faced with an electorate that was determined to see Labour out of office. And it was, you know, it was just astonishing the different perception of that same individual, you know, that same government abroad, compared to being back at home.
I think it's good that you took video cameras and tried to recreate that story at home, because I guess that it can mean the world to people, but you can't see it sort of like on your doorstep just as easily back then, I suppose. But that's an incredible achievement. Like, my next question is, you said that the governments were quite positive about this funding, but did you face any opposition for, like, the UK playing this role, like perhaps among constituents? Or,
I mean, yes, of course. I mean, there's a segment of the electorate that basically believe, you know, a shorthand, charity begins at home. What are we doing helping all these foreigners? It's nothing to do with us. Let's look after our own first. And that, I suspect that that mentality has always been there amongst some electors. It probably ultimately led to, you know, a Brexit vote, the way the Brexit vote went, that, you know, that view. And part of it, the tragic bit is for me, part of it is because not enough effort was made to actually make the case for aid. So the Secretary of State I work for, Douglas Alexander, you know, he insisted that as junior ministers and him himself, we used to go around the UK talking to groups in different constituencies about the value of aid, to constantly keep making that case, because we knew just how fragile support for it could be. So, you know, after the economic shock of the financial crash, that's when I was involved in trying to say that we need to spend more money overseas as well. So you've got this, you know, this challenge, and that's why the idea of morally and ethically right thing to do, but also it's in yourself, you know, it's the UK self-interest to do it as well. That approach was taken. But, you know, what I would say, Marie, is the first refugee camp that you visit in person is an experience that you never ever forget. And I've got a photograph of my first refugee camp, my visit, on my office wall in my current job. And it's a reminder to anybody who comes into my office when we have a conversation about, you know, the work I'm involved with now. Things like that matter and stay with you. So you can see it on the telly and you can hear it on the radio, but it's not the same as being there in person. And when you are there in person, it should be a life-changing experience. And I think it is. And certainly when we talk about the political situation at the moment and what the government have done in proposing that aid is cut from the 0.7 target, I think politically that might be quite problematic for them. Even though they've got a big majority, I suspect there are a number of people in the Conservative Party who actually, because of their experiences, recognise the value, not just, you know, at an individual level in terms of what you can do for a particular development crisis, but the value of what global leadership can bring for maintaining that level of spend. So when you see people like Theresa May and David Cameron saying cutting it is the wrong thing to do, you know that there will be some opposition within the Conservative Party. And I know, because I've written to my own MP, you know, Harriet Baldwin, and she has said that if it comes to a vote in Parliament, she will vote against the cut. Now, she had been a former development minister, so she has seen herself what it can do. And actually, you know, I don't think it's a, you make a political, party political case at this stage for it. We let the Conservatives work it out themselves what's best. But certainly going forward, I think there's a very strong case that Labour should recommit itself to 0.7. It should recommit itself to having a separate and independent Department for International Development, because, as I said, it's one of those issues that's not just limited to Labour Party voters voting for it. It's part of a more progressive, enlightened view. And if you can get churches and Rotary clubs also backing that view, it starts to build up a picture that the Labour Party is sensible and wants to do the right thing, you know, morally as well as, let's say, economically. And that's the right image that you want to create as a party leader. So I think that the Conservatives work it out themselves what they want to do. But if they have not done another U-turn and gone back and maintained 0.7, then I think Labour should make sure it commits itself to do so going forward.
We've talked a lot about the power of Labour in government as a way of creating change in the UK with the five pledges, and also as a way of creating kind of a better world, and your part in that. And we've talked about how in a middle England constituency, you were able to sell that to the electorate and carry people with you, and how essentially it was reflective of their values, the voters' values as well. So I suppose as we kind of come to a close, when you look to the future, who do you see as being the key groups with those values that Labour needs to unite in order to build an electoral coalition of 51%, like you managed in 1997 or something like that? How does Labour approach that now with 3 years out from the election?
This will mean more to you, Nathan, than perhaps others listening to this podcast. And you know, if there are any doubt, they should look up the sort of local geography of Worcester. So I'm going to talk in terms of the geography of Worcester. So you'll get it. Others will be a bit bemused by it. But what I will say is, for Labour to be electorally successful, it's got to appeal to voters on the St. Peter's estate in Worcester, which is an owner-occupied commuter estate, primarily. Warnham Villages in Worcester, which is again a sort of post-1990s estate filled with, you know, commuters and professionals. It's got to have large chunks of their electorate wanting to vote Labour, as much as the likes of the Ronkswoods and the Warndons, which are the historic, what we call Labour heartland seats. You've got to have that broad appeal for places like Worcester. I've said it, you know, to, you know, all the people who have succeeded me as Labour candidates, that That's how you win. You know, there aren't enough votes just in your heartlands to get you to win a general election. You've got to appeal to areas that might not be what you class as traditional Labour areas. Now, how you get that appeal, there's a range of different policy areas where you can appeal to them, but it's going to be on the basis that if you've got a mortgage, I'll go back to the sort of Worcester woman thing. If you've got a mortgage and you're in a job, you've got your young kids at school, what matters to you? Well, you want a decent school. So you go back to that key pledge that we made in 1997 about class sizes for 5, 6, and 7-year-olds. You can tell it's ingrained for all these years ago. Small class sizes gave a signal that we were looking for better education and a better start for young people at that age. Now, what parent doesn't want that? That's the broad appeal that you've got to try and bring about, and you do it on the 5 issues. You could pick 7. Doesn't make any difference really. But if you go too big, have too big a wish list, it becomes impractical. A nice straightforward list, and you concentrate your campaigning on that. But that offering has got to have that broad appeal. So appealing not just to the traditional Labour voters, not just to Labour Party members, or at worst, Labour Party activists, which is a very, very narrow band within the broad electorate. You've got to appeal to make sure that at least 51% vote for you in Worcester. And then you'll not only win, you'll win well, and you'll be able to form a government. And forming a government is everything, because you can do stuff. And that's the key. If you want to stay in opposition and have great sound bites and have protests and feel good about yourself, fine, go and do that if that's what you want. You won't change people's lives. If you want to change people's lives for the better, you've got to be in government to do it. Now, whether you want to change them internationally or locally, government is where you do it. And that's got to be the focus for Keir Starmer going forward.
Being trustworthy in leadership, being disciplined on the way through, having a broad appeal to people all across these Middle England seats, because forming a government is everything. Thank you so much, Mike, for joining us today and sharing those insights with us.
Thank you, no problem at all.